What's happening? Welcome to Wong Notes Podcast. I'm your host, Corey Wong. I'm feeling good today. I just finished my Stanley Cup bracket. You know, I got in a little late. I know we're a couple games in. I'm a hockey guy, okay? Yeah, I'm from Minnesota. I'm a hockey guy. What do you expect? I play music. I decided to go into music and not hockey. Look at me. My physique lends itself better to music. My boys in the Wild are out of the playoffs this year, so I don't know who to root for. I'm all over the place. But tell you what, I can't believe I'm starting this podcast with a hockey rant. That's what you get here. You're getting straight off the top of the dome. I don't want my boys in the Minnesota Wild to think I abandoned them. I was looking online. I saw there was a lot of empty seats for that last game. I had to rally. Put the call. Hey, everybody, we're going to the Wild. We got to support the boys. Doesn't matter if this game, quote unquote, doesn't count. You got to support your team. You got to support your Cats, okay? I went out to the last game. I cheered. I stayed all the way to the end. I'm going to support them all the way, okay? That's my boys. That's my boys. I'm still proud of them, no matter what the scores are, okay? Hometown, Minnesota, state of hockey. Anyways, wow, never done a hockey rant on a guitar podcast before. Always a first. Tell you what, today's guest, Al Di Meola, speaking of athletics, it is an athletic feat what this cat has been able to pull off on the guitar over the last several decades. I've been a fan of Di Meola since I was a kid. My dad got me hip to this record. He had this record collection that was insane. And there was a Di Meola record. The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, that's the guy from that one live concert record that my dad has. Where is the three guys up there playing? Absolutely legendary album with John McLaughlin and Paco de Lucia. Incredible record. You got to check it out if you're not familiar. Also, Return to Forever, Al Di Meola solo records. This cat is a ledge in the jazz and jazz fusion world. He has this book that was like a kind of jazz study book that I might be out of print that I remember I found a weird copy of when I was in college. Studied a bunch of that. Studied a bunch of these cats' books and learned a ton. Al's a great player. Fun to talk to him. Cat's all over the place, man. He's in Miami. He's in Jersey. He's in Italy. Must have been good living around the time when you could sell actual records. Not going to have that Italian villa off streaming. Tell you what. Man, are we about to go into another rant? Are we about to go into a streaming rant? No. Not the right place. Not the right time. Plus, you probably listened to this on Spotify or something. You're like, whoa, what am I doing here? I've got cognitive dissonance about the whole thing now. It's fine. It doesn't matter. It's the world we live in. I'm stoked to be here. Look, my voice is making it to your ears. Hopefully, my guitar player is making it to your ears. That's what we're doing here. You know, we're having some fun. Tell you what, though, it's a guitar podcast. If you want to get better at the guitar, I have just the course for you. The Corey Wong Guitar Course. Now, some people are like, oh, is this just a rhythm guitar or funk guitar course? No. This is to make you an all-around, well-rounded player, make you a better session musician, make you a better band member, make you better at playing at jam sessions, get your chops in order, okay? You gotta have chops. Nowadays, it's a given. You gotta come with your A game every time. There's just a demand for excellence. If you're not excellent at what you do, you're not even in the conversation. That's just step one. This course is gonna get you excellent at what you do, but I'm also going to explore the thing that is the X factor, which is creativity, artistry, and moving beyond just excellence at the thing you do, the craft of playing the guitar, and moving into finding creative ways to use these things and use your voice on the instrument. Anyways, I've had a couple of cups of coffee. It's past 6 p.m. My bracket is popping right now. I'm not going to tell you who I have winning because I don't know if I'm proud of it yet. I don't know. But there's some games on the tube tonight. I'm working on mixing a record on my computer. Got the TV up. Going to be watching some Stanley Cup. It's just a good night. I hope you're having a great day. I hope you enjoy this interview with Al Di Meola. And guess what? We have a couple more episodes in this season. Gonna blow you away. So stoked. Thanks for hanging with us. Here we go.
Hey, you guys know about DistroKid yet? If you are an artist, musician, somebody who's trying to get your music on Spotify, Apple Music, all of those things, DistroKid is a digital distributor that can get your music on all of those platforms. It's the easiest, fastest way to do so, with accounts even just starting at $19.99 a year per artist. So for me, I have several albums out. I just pay one amount for the year. For all the Corey Wong albums, I just pay one amount, and DistroKid takes 0% royalty. 100% of the royalties come straight to me. Or you use their Teams feature where you can dedicate a certain percentage to one member of your band, a certain percentage to the other, or one of your collaborators. I do this sort of thing. It works amazing. DistroKid is who I use for my albums, and it has worked great for me. The stuff gets up there fast. They have a smart ISRC thing. I don't have to worry about coming up with my own codes, registering a lot of the stuff. They just have that. And they also have these really cool design tools. If you are not very design savvy, they'll help you come up with assets for social media and other things to help promote your album. And if you want to use them, you can use my VIP code. Just go distrokid.com/VIP/CoreyWong and you get 30% off. How about that? Check them out, DistroKid. All right, let's hit this episode. Well, Al, so good to see you, man. Thanks for hanging with us today.
Thank you, man. Yeah, it's a real pleasure.
Yeah, where are you at right now? Are you at home? Are you on the road? Where are you at?
I'm at my home in Miami Beach, like right on the beach.
Nice. I'll tell you what, the best smelling hotel I've ever been to in my life is Faena, or however you say
Faena is amazing.
In Miami?
Yeah.
That place smells incredible when you walk
there,
man.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. They have a really cool lounge. It's like a living room. It's not like a nightclub at all. It's like a really cozy lounge. And they usually have a band playing. And, you know, there is a bar and everything. But there's beautiful couches all over the place. It's just the place is amazing, you know.
When you go out to see a band at a place like that, are you able to enjoy it or are you constantly scrutinizing? Where are you at? I go in cycles with this.
I don't go out that much to see bands, although I'm not adverse to it. But it's just, you know, I'm usually here working on some music, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what, man, this new track, Fandango, fantastic.
Thank you, man.
Man, I love this tune. It is just a beautiful melody. And the guitars come in nicely. And then I was so pleasantly surprised when the orchestration and everything came in. The arrangement and the choice of instrumentation was just incredible. I love this tune.
Thank you, man. Yeah, it's one of the few times I've orchestrated for brass, you know. And it just called for it. It was kind of a majestic piece in the way, you know, reminded me of like, you know, gliding over the Alps, you know. And it just, you know, I had, you know, a whole lot of time in the COVID year and the next year as well to be off and to get my mind off of the news. It was like therapy to go down into the studio back in New Jersey, that is. And it's just keep writing, because that's writing or reading music takes my mind off of whatever the dilemma is in the world or personal, you know. So, yeah, I had so much extra time that this record that was deemed to be a solo acoustic project, just everything solo, no overdub at all, just grew and grew until it became a big production record. And it's also expanded into it being a double record. So it's two records.
I love that.
16 brand new compositions, and they're all very involved. I hope I don't have to do this again.
Well, really. Your tone is also incredible on this. Because I have questions when it comes to acoustic guitar. Now, I know you're about to go on tour this record, and you got a lot of great dates. I was looking at your tour dates. I'm wondering, when you play acoustic guitar live,
yeah,
because you've been doing this a lot of years, you've probably run the gambit on miking DI acoustic guitar. We got it tough out there as guitar players with acoustic guitar. How do you get a good tone when you're playing live? Where are you at with that?
Well, in the studio, it's a little different, of course. But, you know, I use in the studio two Shure mics. And then I also mic with a Neumann. I forgot the number, but it's the little black pencil mic. The AER acoustic amp, the smaller version.
Yeah.
So I'm up close mic'd with two Sheps cross mic'd and fairly close. And I've been using Shep for the last 30 years plus, since 83, I think. So even longer than 35 years. So yeah, they, cause I was always asking my engineer what ECM, the label ECM uses to get that crystal clear sound. And the engineer was very familiar with ECM and their recording techniques. So he recommended I buy a pair of Sheps. So they've been my standard mics. Also very good for grand piano, not for a distorted amplifier, electric, but very good for acoustic instruments, you know.
Is that what you're using live too?
No, for live I don't use the Sheps because it'll pick up everything around you. And that you don't want that. So I use a Neumann, that little black pencil mic. It's kind of the same shape. It looks like a kind of a cigar almost. And I go direct through my RMC box because I have an RMC pickup on my acoustic. So I'm able to get some volume other than just the microphone in front of me. And we run it out of the AER, that tiny little AER amp, which is barely just cracked on slightly.
Nice. Well, you have a very percussive picking style and a lot of it very demanding as far as how you play. Where'd you learn that from? And was there a point where you got away from more legato playing?
Well, legato playing is there when needed, but I was always, I think I was from the get-go, a frustrated or destined drummer or percussionist because I hung out in Latin clubs and I spent my last couple of years in high school completely not paying attention and just kind of tapping out rhythms on the top of the desk and figuring that I could somehow transfer my sense of rhythm combinations to my guitar playing, you know. So there is a lot of syncopation, you know, mixed with counterpoint on a lot of my compositions. And over the years, compositions have become the central focal point more than what a lot of young kids are doing. When you pop on your phone every day, you see this new young kid that just popped out. He's probably 2 years old and he's playing fast. It's like, that's not my goal these days is I don't get impressed with that kind of thing. That was cool back in the mid 70s and it carried me through. But really, I come from a band when I started out, and the band was the most compositional band of the three leading fusion bands, you know. So I was inspired by composition and also the excitement of the velocity of what fusion was all about because it was new and exciting.
So what does impress you about young and up-and-coming guitar players these days?
Well, I think, there's a lot of young guys that have got very impressive technique and impressive lines, but it's against nothing. There's no composition. So the question I would ask is, well, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to apply it? What's it used in? Is there anything to use it in? Those are the questions. So that's not always so easy. Like I can come up with like 20 phenomenally weird sounding fast lines, but where are you going to use it? It's how you tastefully place it within the solo context of hopefully a good composition. Because, you know, after a while, the players that have lived on technique alone and really lacked on the side of composition, because it's a whole other profession almost, let's say, you get tired of it. You know, there's not a girl in the audience that cares for that stuff. They get moved by the the emotion of the story within the context, you know, with the, of the composition rather, you know, and that's where I put my importance. You know, I'd rather be known as a composer, guitarist than the other way around, you know.
Well, the other thing about guitar players is that so many of them, they're working on their technique, doing their thing. Not everybody really focuses on finding their voice on an instrument.
Right.
I'm curious, as somebody who's been around and done this thing with also so many other great guitar players, what is it that's required to find a unique voice on the instrument? And to you, what is it that makes certain players stand out amongst others?
Oh, well, the second part's easy to answer. The players that stand out for me, with, you know, it doesn't have to be guitar specific, are the ones that have immaculate articulation and, of course, great technique. But the articulation of how they deliver the phrasing and how within the context of the paragraph of that little story they're telling and the solo, how it's articulated on certain notes. It could be upbeats. It could be whatever. It's not all linear, you know, and you know, when it has to be strong, the articulation of the player, like a Chick Corea or Gonzalo Rubalcaba, or as a drummer, Steve Gadd. I mean, those are the kinds of guys. And then when I used Anthony Jackson, because he played with a pick, you know, there's some great things to be said about, you know, guitarists or bass players that play with a pick. Because you do have the ability to actually articulate a little bit more than hands.
Yeah.
But not everybody that plays with a pick has strong articulation. You know, and when you set out to try to find a voice or your own style, I think I don't know if you do that. I think you kind of listen to the guys that are your heroes at the time. So for young kids, if it was Joe Satriani or if it was whatever, or Steve Vai or somebody that's, you know, the newer generation, let's say, from where I came from, they'll try to do what they're doing, but eventually they'll probably realize that what's emerging is their own slant or their own voice, because everybody sounds kind of different, you know. But to set out to find that is really just a discovery thing that happens along the way.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting what you say about articulation. With your type of picking style, do you have to have your guitar set up in a certain way to get your thing?
No, not really, no. It's set up pretty normal. I mean, if, at the moment, my nylon guitar, and I got to tell you, to play a nylon with the same velocity as an electric guitar or even an Ovation steel string it's three times harder. It's just way harder because of the response time of a nylon is not the same as the response of a steel string. And usually on a nylon, especially the mine, I think the height is too high. The string height on from the neck to the string is way up there. It has to come down, but if you could train your hand to execute, it takes a lot of practice, and it's frustrating, and it takes a lot of muscle, you know, movement in the hand to, you know, more energy must be exerted, in other words, to do what you could do on those other instruments and do it the same on a nylon. Yeah.
When you recorded the first guitar trio album, Friday Night in San Francisco, three acoustic guitar players, did you feel that was an exceptional night just on its own in the middle of a tour? Or was that just like, was that one shot to record a live album? What was the process?
The live album was the last of two shows after 2 months of touring nearly every night. But 2 months of touring in that era, where there was not anything close to a cell phone, that had not emerged yet.
Yeah.
No computers have emerged. So the amount of time that we spent every day in our hotel rooms or wherever we may have been to prepare for that night show was totally devoted to our chops. So that gave, like, if I look at the average of time I spend on my phone, it's probably not much different than a lot of other people. But, you know, 5 hours more is a lot of time to have extra, you know. Nowadays, it's like if you're backstage, you're looking at your phone. When you're finished with the show, you're looking at your phone. When you're in the hotel room, you're mostly dealing with the phone. You have to really try to discipline yourself to put the phone down, but it's hard. So I think in that era, we knew that we were up against, I knew that I was up against two guys that are relentless in their delivery of phenomenal ideas. And when they finished the solo, it was like, oh my God, now what am I going to come up with? And you would just have to go beyond what you normally might play. You have to play outside more. You have to like experiment more. And there were nights that were phenomenal. There were nights that, you know, that could have been better. But there were nights that were absolute magic, especially within the interplay, because the three of us did have a considerable amount of technique ability. So we could deliver, very quick ideas and have conversations in that sense. But it was the solos that really mattered, you know, whereas, you know, in years after that, it was the compositions that matters. I didn't want to make records full of 5,000 mile an hour runs and stuff most of the time. It worked for that trio. I mean, it worked to the degree of 7 million records. So it was a huge record that people still talk about, you know, all over the world. And then in the COVID year, I found, because I had all the tapes of the whole 2 month tour from 1980. I went in my back room where all of these tapes, about 100 boxes, 2-inch reels. And I found that there was a Saturday night that we almost forgot that we played a second night in San Francisco. And I found alternate pieces. They probably weren't our first choice pieces, but they were still good enough for a record.
That's incredible. That's so dope. Well, you use the verbiage going up against these two guys. Was that the energy? Was it like a real competition vibe, or did you feel like you were on the same team?
We were on the same team, but it was a real it was a real healthy competition, because, you know, the guy would do a solo and do like maybe, you know, 20 choruses of like mind-blowing stuff, and then it became either the other guy's turn or your turn, and it's like, oh my God, now I gotta come up with something, you know. So you have to have the agility and the ability with the agility, you know, to be able to execute things that you hear in your head beyond. And really kind of, you're doing it to impress the other guys. We were trying to impress one another. The audience got the benefit of us having this little, very healthy competition. You know, I hate to use the word competition, but it really was in a sense, because we were all out to do our best, you know, but it was cool and healthy, especially in the beginning.
Yeah. Well, and I can imagine also, I mean, three monster guitar players in a room. Guitar players are notorious. You know, we are notorious for being somewhat territorial. A lot of times you're messing with egos when it's other guitar players you're playing with.
All of that.
How did you manage that? Or did it feel, what was your experience with that?
It was challenging. I mean, I think I was more closer with Paco, because Paco had recorded with me on Elegant Gypsy three years before that. Mm-hmm. And that became a hit single, believe it or not, the Mediterranean Sundance version of it. And then we talked about touring, and then we were approached somewhere in the beginning of 1980 or the end of 79 by an impresario out of London named Barry Marshall, who basically books McCartney and Pink and Elton John, and is the biggest. But he started in the business with us as a young guy. And it was his idea to put the trio together with McLaughlin. I said, well, if you do that, this thing is going to explode. But it really was way bigger than we all imagined, especially in terms of later on in terms of sales. And then, of course, we did a couple of reunion tours soon thereafter. One in 83 and I think one in 95 or 81 and 95, I forget. Yeah, and then later it became, there was some tension, let's put it that way. Look, I was the young guy. I was 12 years younger than John. And Paco was somewhere in between. And, you know, John and I are at least we're friendly and we're talking to one another now. But there was a lot of years we weren't, you know, there was some animosity there. We cleared up a lot of stuff. And when I told him I found the tapes, he didn't even want to talk to me. So I had to basically convince him. I said, let me just send you a track. You can just say no, yes or no. You know, this is nothing behind anyone's back. I just happened to have listened to one track, and I was blown away with the excitement of it. So he goes, okay, send me something. So I sent it, and I didn't hear from him. I mean, he was pretty much sequestered in France because of the COVID thing. It was hitting hard, you know, still first quarter of 2020. So I also thought it was a good time to call him because, you know, we're all concerned for one another, you know, what's happening with humanity in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw the more of the compassionate side of John, and he eventually really liked what he heard. He said, man, I'd love to hear the rest of it. So when he heard the rest of it, it was like a go. You know, we went to the Paco's widow, and she was very amenable. And the whole thing came together. And so the thing that may have irked John a little bit was that, you know, or just disappointed him, was he couldn't get involved with it. I had to do all the editing and all, you know, all of the mixing, because there was no easy way to travel at that. And during that period, you know, so it became kind of my project. Not that I was totally into having meeting John or having John come over, whatever the case may be, but it was, we all had to be very, very careful of not getting COVID, because we, at that time, in the first quarter of 2020, we thought if we got COVID, we have a good chance of dying. So I kept busy, and that came out. And then I worked on my new album that has Fandango on it. And that record exploded because I worked on it for 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
And with that 3 to 4 years, I produced 2 albums worth. And I figured there's no way the record company is going to want to release 2 records, you know, a double album. Double albums, even when we were in the glory period of the recording industry, was record companies hated it. Because it would mean the price would go up and cost more to make and less people would buy it. But my company, when I mentioned it, they said, oh, that's great. They were so excited. I said, wow, okay. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I would want it out is because it was music made in this period. I don't want to 5 years from now release the second half of the record. It should all come out now. It goes against the grain of what people do when they listen to music, which is basically skip, you know, short attention span, shorter than ever. This goes against the grain. You notice the song was long. There's a lot of them that are long, and the record long. So, yeah, it's once again, I'm going against the grain.
I have been on a quest the last 4 years
right.
to find the best tiramisu in the world.
Oh,
you've got an album called Tiramisu. You do a Italian cooking night at your house that I need to come hang at.
Yeah.
Tell me what's going on. Tell me what's going on with your Italian cooking night. Tell me where I can find the best tiramisu in the world.
You know, we just had a phenomenal, like the best we ever had in our lives in Europe last week. And I think it was maybe it was Zurich or something. I don't remember. But it was after the show, we had dinner, and everybody said, this is the best tiramisu ever. So, but yeah, it's a really a northern Italian dessert. It has very little to do with my style of cooking and my heritage. Sure. You know, we don't make creamy desserts. Not that much. I mean, we, you know, okay, cannolis are from Sicily. So it's considered the southern Italian dessert. But the best dessert from Napoli, which is really where my family or, you know, the whole family comes from, that whole region, the most famous dessert, the one that will blow you away, is called sfogliatella. Sfogliatella.
All right, I got to get hip.
Yeah, sfogliatella will blow you away, especially if it's got to be crisp and it can't be soggy. So you can't leave it out and then the next day eat it because it'll be soggy by then. So it has to be, it's very flaky and very crisp. And
yeah,
it's really the most incredible dessert you will have ever had.
I like that.
And they're hard, they may be hard to find. You know what we do now is we get them directly from Napoli. And we freeze them, and then we put them in the oven, and they come out like they were brand new. But the whole cooking thing started in the summer of 2020 when people were outside walking in the streets. You know, everybody was out of work. And, you know, so a high school friend came over with his wife, and I mentioned to my wife that, you know, I wouldn't mind, you know, making something for everybody. Because my wife is also a great cook. So she said, all right, if you want to. I said, yeah, I got this pasta dish that's going to blow them away. They can never get this in any restaurant. So I went ahead. I was feeling really good, a few glasses of wine, you know, kind of enjoying being home, to be honest. And I said to my wife, why don't you go live stream? She goes, really? I said, yeah, go live stream. Let them watch me cook. So we were getting like tons of like incoming from South America, Europe, Asia, the States, you name it. And so in the middle of the live stream, I wasn't really reading stuff as it was coming in. I was still busy. But in the middle of the live stream, I looked up at the phone and, you know, I just made a mention. I said, and if you guys want to come here, you know, we could maybe make, you know, we could do this for you live in person.
Yeah.
You know, and so I was kidding. I didn't mean it. I wasn't thinking at all about actually doing it. But then we read
your manager's going, let's go, baby.
No. The manager actually, when they found out this, that was brilliant. I said, yeah, it actually was brilliant. But, you know, we read the comments, and there was like so many people asking, are you serious? I said, well, you know what? I said to my wife, maybe we could do this. This might be a great idea. And what we do is after dinner, first we serve all these hors d'oeuvres, all the Italian appetizers under the sun. You know, all the wines, champagnes, we decorate the place like they're walking into like the most amazing house ever.
Yeah.
And then we'll have like a 3-hour dinner with like 3 courses and all the best Italian desserts at the end. Then we'll go down to my studio and I'll give a private show and offer a lesson at the end or a jam at the end, which no one ever took that, but they just love the show. And yeah, so when we got the first one that summer, it was one of the hottest days. It had to be like over 100 degrees. The guy arrived, he was completely drenched, came by himself from Detroit. And I said, dude, you got to go upstairs in the guest room and take a shower. Right. Like, oh, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. No, go take a shower. It was so hot. You know, so the funny thing is at the end of the night, he goes, okay, after the show, the private show, he goes, I'd like to jam with you. I said, oh, great. Okay. Just pick any guitar. I had them all out. And he goes, oh, no. I don't mean guitar. I said, what do you mean? He goes, I brought my cowbell. I looked at my wife and I went, I said, well, what the hell? he paid for it, you know? So I started playing, and he was hitting the cowbell completely out of time, you know? And I just sat there going, you know what? This is still a great way to make money. And also I have a charity, which we set up, Tinnitus Charity. So it was like, wow, this is really a cool... It doesn't matter if he's playing in time. It doesn't matter if he wants to sing and he's out of tune. What matters is that he could say to his friends, I jammed with Al Di Meola.
I'll tell you what, though. If I'm coming over, I'm a stickler about pizza because nowadays I'm only getting pizza. I'm a Napoli-style pizza guy. I go to places that are VPN certified. Got that.
I know the best places.
Vera Pizza, Napolitana, verified. Places. Those are the only places I go to. I only get VPN pizza now.
Where are you located?
So I'm in Minneapolis.
Oh, Minneapolis. Okay.
Wow. But I'm all over the place. So
we'll be playing up there, you know.
Yeah, you're playing at the Dakota in a few weeks.
Yeah, two nights. Yeah. Yeah. Down here, I know the best places in New York with guys, everybody in the place that works there from Napoli. And we found, their offshoot places in right near us in Fort Lauderdale, outside of Fort Lauderdale. And we went there, I guess it was a month ago, and I have to say it was the best pizza I ever had in my life, even better than the best places in Napoli.
All right, let's say we're stuck. Let's pretend that you and I are on tour together. We're stuck. The only place in town to eat is Olive Garden. What's the least offensive item on the menu that you're ordering?
Chicken.
Just straight up, you just a piece of chicken?
Well, whatever's on it, scrape it off. You know, you don't want to scrape that shit off because basically, you know, they don't know at all how to cook. Zero. Okay, so if they're putting any kind of tomato sauce on there, it's certainly not going to be San Marzano. So they don't even know what San Marzano is. And that's a specific kind of tomato from Napoli. And all the best Napolitan pizza places, or even places, they use San Marzano tomatoes. So the tomatoes that look like pears, they're kind of oblong.
Yeah, they display them. They got to have them on display so you know, dude.
Yeah, so I don't even have to ask, but I'm sure I would be going there to ask anyway. But Olive Garden is not going to use any quality stuff like that, you know. No way. And I would not get the pasta because the typical American likes it soft, which is like, you know, there should be a law against it, you know.
Got to be cooking al dente, baby. You got to be al dente, dude.
A lot of people don't like it that way, and that's just too bad. I mean, that's the way it should be enjoyed. And if they cook it soft,
are we gonna completely ignore the al di meola, al dente? Where are we going with this? Is there's something there? Come on.
Yeah, yeah. It's my heritage. Food is the most important thing, probably.
I like that. You got the album Tiramisu. You need al dente now, dude.
You know what tiramisu means?
What does it mean?
Lift me up.
I like that. I like that. Cue the DMB, dude. Every day. Lift me up every day, dude. Cue the DMB. Let's get back to some music questions. I got a question because you're a composition cat. You're all about composition now. You did a couple records where you interpreted the Beatles music. When you took the time to do those records, what did you learn about composition?
Well, when I worked on the Beatles stuff, I looked for the pieces that had enough of harmonic movement. Of course, the melodies are outstanding. But the harmonic movement of those pieces, you could do a lot with that. They really had beautiful harmonic movement in a lot of their music, even though the songs were on the extremely short side. Like, yeah, more than 3 minutes was like a big deal in the beginning for them.
Yeah.
Up until probably Magical Mystery Tour, you know. So if you were doing something prior to that, you know, there wasn't a lot of meat. You know, you had, if you eliminate the voice and the lyrics, you know, you really have to, you really can't copy what they did because then it would be less than what they did. So I had to do my thing with it which is respect the aesthetic quality of those pieces, because I view them as very aesthetic pop pieces, you know. I took pieces like Norwegian Wood, for instance, that when you hear the original version, and as beautiful as it is, no one ever, you know, complained about it, but it was a song that was, I think it was under 2 minutes, but you don't think about it. Now, yeah. If I were to do that instrumentally and it was under 2 minutes, it would really be like, that's it, you know? So I wrote a lot of music as if, you know, to extend it, like, where would they go with it if they were going to develop this?
Sure.
You know what I mean? And no matter how much I wrote, and sometimes I wrote a lot, like in Strawberry Fields, Norwegian Wood in particular, you're not allowed to take any credit, and neither did I care to get it. I just wanted to deliver my vision of how I would hear it if it were instrumental. And it was a project of passion, especially the first one. The first one was really intended to be just solo acoustic, and not invite people to come in and not start adding keyboard layers or drummers or bass, and just do a, you know, a very unique kind of project, which I wound up being, you know, really, really happy with the end result, because it was not me doing the Beatles like the Beatles do it. So you already have 10,000 albums of artists that are trying to do what the Beatles are doing, for reasons that blow my mind, because the Beatles did it the best. You can't even come close.
Yeah.
Right? But they do it like that.
Yeah, you know?
So if you're going to do it, you gotta, hopefully have something unique to say, but also retain the aesthetic nature of it. And not go too crazy like some jazz artists have completely ruined the you know, their renditions of the Beatles by altering every chord so dissonantly that it makes it it's like it doesn't need. I know you're trying to hippify it, but if you hippify it too much and all of a sudden it's not that pretty song anymore. And sometimes you can't even recognize it because the melody is buried within a dissonant chord, you know?
Yeah. Now you're getting cute with the pizza. Now you're putting all kinds of whack. Now you're putting Fruity Pebbles on the pizza when you didn't need Fruity Pebbles on the pizza.
It's like when they put the pineapple on the pizza, it's like, you know, it's there should be a law, you know?
Are you like morally offended when pineapple is on the pizza?
I'm morally offended with pineapple. I'm morally offended when they call sauce gravy. Never call tomato sauce gravy. Gravy's brown. Mashed potatoes.
Oh, I'm going to go with you there. I mean, the thing is, have you had pineapple on pizza, though? It can be. We don't have to call it pizza, but you put pineapple on some dough, tomato sauce, and cheese. It's not bad. It's kind of good.
Yeah, the good part was the tomato and the cheese. So you got 75% good. The pineapple just didn't belong there, you know. So what overwhelms the taste is that sauce. Now if the sauce is dark. Now we're getting this is like a food lesson.
That's fine.
If you
come
see
at me.
Pizza like, you know, at a shitty place like Pizza Hut or any of those kind of Caesar's pizza, those delivery places. What you're probably going to notice is that the sauce is dark red.
All right.
Run for the hills.
Okay.
Dark red sauce is a very low grade sauce, usually loaded with acid. You ever get acid reflux? You know,
I have not.
So much acid in that sauce, which has the totally wrong taste. People don't know better. I mean, a lot of these, especially Midwest, they don't know what a Monopoly pizza
tastes like.
They
don't know, dude. You're basically at a Grateful Dead show at that point. There's so much acid.
Yeah. They don't really know what great pizza is, you know.
That's
right, dude. Maybe if they had it, they still wouldn't get it. You know, you have to be somewhat of a connoisseur of fine food, you know.
You got to go back to basics. The tomato, that's it. That's a PH joke. on the acids. All right, I'm glad to hear you're so passionate about this, though. I mean, that's the thing is, a lot of cats that are really good at an instrument, that passion and that dedication carries over into something else. And for you, it's Italian food. I like that. Well, you're paving the way for Mark Lettieri to someday become a good Italian chef. Before we close up here, tell me a bit. You're about to go on tour. What's the band configuration? Is it electric? Is it acoustic? What can people expect from this upcoming tour?
Well, this time I'm pulling out all the stops. This is an electric tour, a kick-ass electric tour, because normally whenever, you know, every 5 to 10 years, I'll get the urge to resurrect the electric thing. The reason why I stayed away from it and I made major changes back in the end of the 70s into the 80s was because of the volume had created a tinnitus, a ringing in the ears that was so bad. And it doesn't go away. It's just something you live with, and it's miserable and horrible, but you just have to deal with it. But, you know, after watching a lot of these kids, you know, it's all electric that they get excited about. And I said to myself, you know, let me put on a few of my early records and see what it is that my fans keep talking about. And, you know, it's quite a bit different when you listen to Elegant Gypsy, Casino, Land of the Midnight Sun, and the early RTF from where I've gone as a writer. So whenever I went out electric in these last 30, 40 years, I would go out majorly featuring the music of that new record that the fans were pretty much not familiar with. And I'd go with that because I figured, well, they'll like whatever I do. Well, to a large extent, they did, but they're not wild about the new stuff because they don't really know it. Now, we went out in January with this concept of doing, let's say, you know, for better or worse, the hits, so what's considered the more familiar songs of my early career that everyone knows if you're a fan. So we, you know, we would do Race with Devil, Egyptian Dons, Senor Mouse. Like every tune is well known to that particular crowd. And the whole night is that. So it's really going back. It's an electric tour going back to the beginning. And even the early RTF pieces that some of them I've always wanted to play live. And Casino is from my third record. It's something I've never played live. An Elegant Gypsy Suite I've never played live. So when I pulled out the charts, for one thing, I was like amazed at how perfect the charts were. I was still living with my parents, but they were just perfectly written and they haven't faded at all. So they were kind of easy to run down, but there was it was more aesthetic in the music than I had given it credit for.
Sure.
Because I had grown as a writer and I just put those to pasture. You know, I just forgot about them. I said, well, what I'm writing now is far more advanced than any of that old stuff. In a sense it is, but there's still something about the early music that I can now put my finger on it because I'm doing it and I see the audience reaction. It's phenomenal.
Love that.
So that's what we're doing. We're slipping in a new piece from the album, of course. We have to do that.
I love it. You're coming to the Dakota here in Minneapolis. I'll be sure to come check you out, man.
Okay, good.
All right.
Come on back and say hello.
I will. All right, well, Al, thanks so much for joining us, man. It's really a treat to speak with you, and I wish you the best of luck on this tour. Excited to see you out there.
Thank you, man. A lot of fun.
Yeah.
Take care, guys.
There you have it. Al Dimeola. I mean, come on. How are you going to do Dimeola, Al Dimeola, and not do Al Dente? I mean, that's got to be a thing. You're going to do these Italian meals? Somebody in his marketing department needs to get it together. I'll do a pitch deck for him if they need. But there's some clever things that could happen in the Al Dimeola marketing world for these dinners. Although the people that I'd be marketing to, they might not get, like, the people with that kind of disposable income might not appreciate my style of marketing. So I might not be the right cat. That's all right. I guess I'll just keep playing guitar. Anyways, thanks for hanging with us. Great to have you with, and we'll see you next time. Peace!